This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Models of management, that's a sticky issue as we consider Mauna Kea and the standoff on the mountain. HBR's Ku'uwehi Reishi is here to talk about that. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So last week, the University of Hawaii's Board of Regents considered a resolution, and it had 12 items. In this resolution, of course, non-binding, so, you know, folks were a little worried about whether we can hold the Board of Regents accountable for what's in this. But one element that was interesting is a request or a call for an in-depth analysis to be done on whether the management of Mauna Kea would be better served if transferred to another authority, a government authority, or perhaps a third party. So we went out to look at some of these models, and the first that came to my mind, mostly because of sort of the related activism, is Ko'olawe and the Ko'olawe Island Reserve Commission. So for those who might not know the entire history there, back in 1941, right after Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States had declared martial law here in Hawaii and actually went, the U.S. Navy went to Ko'olawe, kicked the ranchers off, and began training for World War II. Ko'olawe became the premier spot for military training in and around the Pacific during World War II. But fast forward to the 1970s, a protest by Native Hawaiians and a group called Protect Ko'olawe Ohana would, I think, last maybe two decades until 1990, when the U.S. Had actually stopped bombing, and the island was returned to the state in 1994 officially. And so right now, the Ko'olawe Island Reserve Commission, a very autonomous body, includes members from, or seats on this commission are offered to folks from Protect Ko'olawe Ohana, and then also several other state agencies, BLNR, County of Maui's on there, Office of Hawaiian Affairs has a seat, and then an open seat for another Native Hawaiian organization. So we were looking for models that sort of broadened the role of Native Hawaiians in this management of this island. I got to speak to Mike Nahopi, who's the head executive director of the commission, and he says the autonomy, because of this, it's a state model, right? So a lot of what they do, they can easily get done because they don't have to go through the hoops of having to go through the Department of Health to get this permit, or County of Maui, because every stakeholder is on this commission.
Right, so they're all sitting at the table.
Exactly, and it is a state-funded model right now, and it's interesting because the focus is restoration-based. So when it comes to Mauna Kea, there's a science and the astronomy involved in there. So this doesn't entirely address that, but Noho'opi'i kind of had explained that at the beginning or at the originating point of their mission, it is to sort of restore the natural resources, but also the cultural practices. So here's Noho'opi'i to explain that.
There's a long history of cultural practices on Ko'olawe, because that's one of the main reasons Ko'olawe was established, was so that Native Hawaiians had a place that they could go and have cultural as a priority, Native Hawaiian traditional cultural practices. So as a reserve, we are set aside for that as a priority versus native plants or fish. So, we're protecting the fish, but we're protecting the fish so that when people want to come and do traditional fishing methods, there's actually fish there, you know.
So a lot of autonomy, I think, is a good way of sort of painting this state model. But we also went to look at a partnership model. So Native Hawaiian organizations, mainly Office of Hawaiian Affairs and the federal and state governments, work on the Papahanaumokuakea National Marine Monument, right? So this massive land-to-sea management model. We spoke to Athleen Clark, who's the monument superintendent for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. And she mentions this permitting system where really this entity is able to balance, or strives to balance, scientific research and cultural significance. And that's something that perhaps we can weave into any sort of future model up on Mauna Kea. But here's Clark explaining how the permitting system works.
We set up a joint permitting system, and we agreed that every permit, even if it was a research permit, had to also go through and have a cultural lens on it. It has to be why there and not elsewhere. Whatever the activity is has to provide a, you know, a value for the place, and we put and a value for the culture.
And that works vice versa as well. Any cultural access or permit requests, what's considered in that process is also the biological impacts, right? What's going to happen to the natural resources if we grant this cultural access? So it was an interesting element of Papahanaumokuʻa Kea's model. And the last model we looked at was more of a community-based approach. So an example would be the Haʻena community-based subsistence fishing area over on Kauai and Moʻomomia Molokaʻi in the works. But the community had gotten together and came up with a list of rules on how they want the resources and the fishing resources in their community to be managed. How can others come in and fish? So, for example, and I'll give you one small example, spearfishing is not allowed at night in those waters. And the idea is that the community wanted that, and they think it will have an impact on sort of replenishing fishing stocks. Overfishing is a problem here across the state. And so Kevin Chang, co-director at Kuaʻaina Uluʻawamo, or KUA, and they work with these communities to help come up with the rules and put them through this process. He explains sort of the importance of this community-based approach versus a state model or perhaps a government partnership with Native Hawaiian organizations.
We use the words like indigenous and local knowledge, situated knowledge, how certain knowledge and ability to respond and manage a situation is best located on the ground in the local place where the people most dependent on the resources are. And it's important in our current age because of things around climate change and ability to build resilient communities. It's important for communities to be able to continue. Now, I'm not saying like this is a new thing, but to continue to be better at taking care of each other and their environment.
Right. So this community-based model, what Chang had mentioned, though, one sort of not downfall, but a weakness, if you were a challenge for these models, is the enforcement aspect
right.
of it.
Who's policing
right.
who, right?
Exactly. And exactly. And so that is a sort of a challenge for that model. And I think for the Native Hawaiian and government partnership model of Papahanaumokuʻa Kea, part of the challenge is sort of the bureaucracy of red tape, because you need buy-in from all these stakeholders, various jurisdictions, various interests. And then the state model, like we had mentioned earlier, great autonomy. But the mission is pretty, everyone's clear on what they're trying to do there. And it is to sort of hold that island in trust for a future Native Hawaiian governing entity. One element that I noticed throughout these models, speaking with Greg Chun, head of Mauna Kea stewardship over at the University of Hawaii, he said, you know, we really need to ask, is with Mauna Kea, is it a science reserve that just so happens to be one of the most culturally significant areas in Hawaii, or is it a culturally significant area that just so happens to be the top spot for astronomy? And once we answer that question and figure out that originating point, can figure out where to go next.
So as far as the resolution that the Board of Regents took, then?
Timeline-wise, April 2020 is actually the date in there, but it is a reso, as we mentioned earlier, non-binding. But in the resolution, it asks for a restructuring plan to be presented to the board in April of next year, and it should include in there an in-depth analysis of whether any of these models could work.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much, Kuʻuvehi.
Yeah.
That was HPR's Kuʻuvehi Hiraishi with a snapshot of possible models of managing Mauna Kea. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from PBS Hawaii's What's It Going to Take? On how Hawaii can move forward and make people's lives better. Live on Insights at PBS Hawaii, 8 p.m. Thursdays, November 14th and 21st. PBSHawaii.org.
Do your feet hurt? Could be first thing in the morning or at the end of the day, but when you have pain in your feet, it can affect the health of the rest of your body. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with an expert about causes of foot pain and what can be done to fix it. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For our Veterans Day Backyard Quiz, we're taking a closer look at the history of the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, which is often referred to by its informal name, Punchbowl Cemetery. As far back as the 1890s, officials in Hawaii were looking at Punchbowl with plans to possibly develop it into a cemetery, but it wasn't until the 1940s that such a plan was actually implemented. The first major push came from a $50,000 congressional appropriation that called for the construction of a national cemetery in Honolulu. After entering the planning phase, it became apparent that the appropriation would be too small to cover construction costs, so the plans were ultimately postponed. By 1947, however, Congress and various veterans organizations requested that a permanent burial site be created for thousands of World War II servicemen who had not yet been interred. After the Army reexamined and revamped the old plans to construct a cemetery atop Punchbowl, Congress eventually approved the needed funding and construction began. The cemetery opened to the public on July 19, 1949, but that was several months after the first servicemen were laid to rest there. For today's backyard quiz, we're wondering if you know when the first servicemen were interred at Punchbowl. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. This past weekend, the National Park Service reopened a section of a scenic route that was closed due to the damage from 60,000 earthquakes linked to the eruption of Kilauea volcano. Access to Byron Ledge and Devastation Trail is another milestone in the long road to recovery. Today, we pause to reflect on the impact that event had to the community, the island, and the state. We recently talked to Star Advertiser's Christy Wilson and photo editor George Lee about a new book out. Fire and Fury is the title, and it compiles not just the drama that played out against the changing landscape, but it puts in context the last 35 years of Kilauea's eruptions.
As the eruption went on, we knew that we were going to have something, but we needed this thing to end before we could even start a beginning. The original idea that Mike Rovner had was to do just the May through August eruption, and then he decided that why don't we make it the 35 years from the 1983 start till the end of August of 2018.
And you had a team of photographers out there covering it.
Yes,
we utilized
our freelancers until we could get out there. We had set up a rotation system where everybody had to go from the most senior of our photographers to the most junior. And even I spent a couple weeks out there documenting what was going on out there.
Yeah, the paper even, we rented a house in Orchid Land, which is in Puna, not far from Pohoa Town. But I think for the paper, it was probably the largest ever deployment, longest ever for sure, of continuous staff. So we actually had people, reporters and photographers, on the ground for at least every day for at least 2 months, I think, before they started.
Yeah, we would go a couple of days before we could, like, platoon people in and
out
of there.
So that's what we were doing. Like, we'd platoon people, like George said, we'd use that term. We'd bring people in, and then they'd rotate out and then rotate back, and new people would come in. But we actually ended up having to rent a house. Just, it was close to where the action was and was a little more economical.
And we started in Ainaloa, at a vacation rental. And then we'd moved to Orchid Land.
I mean, that smart idea, because that was your base camp.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It was for me as a veteran reporter, it was kind of, I always hesitate to use the word fun because obviously there were a lot of terrible things that happened to a lot of people out there, but it was really an amazing assignment for me. And to be back in those situations where you have a lot of camaraderie, not just with your own people, but, you know, there was a whole team of TV reporters, I mean, international people, national reporters, and it was just, it was energizing to be covering that story, but also to be among this crew of people. And, you know, we were all decked out in our flak jackets and wearing our hiking boots, and it was kind of rugged, but it was also
helmets,
just, yeah,
gas masks.
Yeah.
I think, too, that was the scary part, right, was the fumes, like, because they were warning people that, we don't know where it's coming, and you just don't, you know, if you're in an area that should be off limits, it's for a reason.
Right. The sulfur dioxide and certainly the lays in the air, so that the change of the wind can bring that stuff over you. And even when you were where you were supposed to be, you could still taste it in the air.
Were you ever, like, really scared at any point?
No, not really. Self-preservation, I think, kind of kicked in. For the most part, we were escorted by the National Guard, and they would always forward deploy a team, measure the air, figure out what's going to happen, which way is the wind blowing, the whole nine yards.
What about for you?
Yeah, it was the same situation. By the time I got there, the National Guard had set up they had daily convoys, actually, where they would bring in media. And, of course, this was to prevent people from sneaking in and wandering where they weren't supposed to go into a hazardous area. So it was very controlled, but they did get us pretty close to the action, and you could hear it, the rumbling. You could hear the constant, you know, noise from the, especially when Fissure 8 started, just became the dominant vent there. And you could see it. You could, like George said, you could smell it. You could hear it. It was really pretty amazing, but I'm not sure I ever felt in danger. I think at the beginning, when before people, the first few days before there was any kind of news infrastructure set up, some of our reporters, I mean, you were at people's houses in their backyards where the lava was shooting up, and it was it was going off, and there wasn't that much control over the media, so that was kind of, I didn't experience
dicey.
That. But yeah, but I think they came back pretty with some pretty good stories.
Well, I think when Vacationland was claimed, right? I mean, when all those homes, hundreds of homes overnight, and then I think to see Mayor Kim, I mean, that was pretty emotional to know
right.
that the depth of loss in that community and the resource was staggering.
One of the things illustrated very nicely in this book is, yes, you have wonderful pictures taken by the photographers of, as Cindy Ellen Russell terms, dancing lava. But I think what this book also illustrates is the stories of the people coming together to help out each other. The hub in Pahoa Town, where people were coming together for information, for clothing, for food, for support, to teams of animal handlers going out to get horses and goats and cattle off the lands, and just what it took to save these animals, you know, because they're assets. It's a farming community. We would see it. Sometimes they were successful and sometimes not, but I think the evidence is in the work.
So, like, how many pictures did you have to sort through?
With the book as a total, we looked at probably about 3,000 images to cover the 35 years, and certainly thousands of frames were taken in that three-month period in 2018, certainly by our guys. Of course, we're also drawing from freelance photographers as well as the National Park Service, as well as the Volcano Observatory, whose work appears here, as well as the wire services also.
I just think, you know, what a bear. I mean, you're just having to edit down. You know, what do you leave out, because there's just so many stunning images.
Mike and I commandeered our large meeting room in the news, and we just printed out the whole book, and we just started to arrange pages and then gather chapters together. And we just kind of got a good idea about the flow of the book. It is set in chronological order, but then you still have the task of having to, again, what are we going to emphasize here?
And so how did that work, Christy? I mean, so did the pictures drive the narrative or what?
Yeah, I think to me, this book is really, even though I wrote the copy, I wrote the introduction, and then I think there are six or seven chapters that cover different phases of the Pu'u'o eruption, which started, as George mentioned, in January 1983. And then when that vent actually collapsed just 3 days before the start of the Leilani Estates eruption in Lower Puna, that period of the Pu'uo eruption ended, and then this new period began, which was actually considered a separate eruption, but yet they all involve Kilauea volcano, and that's the span of the book. But I think, to me, it was, like I said, the pictures tell the story. And in the copy, what we tried to do was describe the geological events as they happened, why they happened. But at the same time, I went through our newspaper archives, I went through our stories, and tried to put in some human stories, quotes from the people at the time, you know, kind of eyewitness accounts, just to give it that more complete picture that it, and I think George touched on it, the book itself, while there's these spectacular photos of lava fountains and flows and all this amazing photography, there's also a lot of photos of the people who were impacted and at their rawest moments. And I tried to do that in the copy, but the book also isn't just the pretty pictures of lava. It tells the human story and how the people were impacted.
Well, when you talk about lava, I mean, it's death in some instances, but it's also life because it's the earth, right?
Right. Yeah, it's a natural process. And the other thing, too, that came across was because I did a story on the people of volcano, and while the lava was flowing down in Puna, Lower Puna, you know, they had all the explosions. They had a series, like I think 60 or more explosive events at the summit.
Yes.
And the ground there, that's where all the earthquakes were happening. So the people in volcano, and it had come to kind of go off at clockwork about every 24 to 28 hours at one point. So they were dealing with that, like there'd be these earthquakes, at least one big earthquake a day, plus a bunch of little ones. And so, you know, they were dealing with that, and I did a story just focusing on them. So there was just so much going on. And then I also went to Ocean View, which is around, you know, South Point and up the coast, where the VOG was the worst. And they had, the Department of Health was having community meetings up there because the VOG there was, people were waking up and their cars were covered in ash. And I mean, and they weren't anywhere near the eruption. So, you know, the impacts were far and wide.
To hear the term lava bombs, you know, for the folks that were injured, whether you were on that lava boat or, you know, the one gentleman that was, I think,
on his lanai.
On his lanai. Right. And he got injured.
There is coverage of the lava boat, and I do believe we do have a picture of that gentleman who was injured.
I think we have a picture of the woman on the boat from her hospital bed. Yeah. So that was, I know, that was really amazing. And in fact, and I think we may have photos of the lava boat too. And then we also have some of the photos that were taken from the water, looking at what the coastal entries looked like, which was really spectacular too.
Okay, so I have to ask now, do you have a favorite photo? I know it's the worst thing to ask a photographer, right? Because there's so many images in here that, you know, you look at the texture and then you look at the human drama, you know, of people's expressions on their faces.
Yes, I think this project, literally, I think it shot itself. It really, really did. The professionalism of our staff, their dogged persistence of, you know, chasing the story down, just really comes through. And I think you really see their heart for the community and for the profession, you know, really, really comes through here.
And what about for you, Christy?
There's you know, like, it's just really hard because there are suspect. But there's a couple. I know one that Cindy Ellen Russell took that's at the very beginning of the book. And there may be another one kind of like it. But it's not really showing any lava. But it just shows it's a desolate road. And the trees are all defoliated. And it's just the sky is orange. And it's, you know, there's these billowing clouds. And you can see the glow of the fissure that's backlighting these barren tree trunks. And to me, that's one of my most vivid pictures or in my own mind that I saw, was just the glow, the whole sky, the whole picture is orange. And I just remember, no matter where you were in Puna, like in Pohoa, where you were still miles from where the fissure was, or even where we were staying in Aina Loa at night, you still saw this glow, like this glow, and just, it just never stopped. And it was, I just couldn't, that was the one thing I just couldn't get over, was just that orange glow that just, no matter where you were, how close you were, how far, it was there, and it was just a constant presence. And these photos kind of remind me of that. And it was kind of hellish. I mean, it was kind of a hellish image. And these two photos, I don't know who took that one. Was that by Cindy too?
Also, or? Yes.
Yeah, there's that just kind of really remind me of what the experience was for me.
I just remember seeing the cracks in the road and just thinking, wow.
Yeah, and I remember one of the fun stories we did, and you know, we were out covering the volcano, and then we were talking to people who had, you know, lost their homes, and that was so sad and so tragic. But I remember Andrew Gomes went out, and he was there. He did two or three stints, but he went down to Uncle Robert's in Kalapana, and you know, the Wednesday night market, and that he did, like, that was still going a Wednesday night, and where people would dance. There was a band. There were booths. But I remember the road going down there, and they would put up signs saying warning, you know, but there were still cracks in the road, and the steam was just coming up out of the ground. And yeah, you're driving over those newly opened cracks. It was a little, you'd kind of step on the gas to get over as fast as you
harrowing.
Could. But we were still going to Uncle Robert's.
Life goes on.
Right?
Life goes on. That was the Star Advertiser's Christy Wilson and George Lee talking about the book that the paper has just released. For information about where to get the book, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I only have two stations, and I listen to HPR 1 and HPR 2. And anytime I'm in my car, I'm listening to one of the two of them, because I can count on either getting news I can use or music that I can listen to if I'm talking to somebody. Hi, my name is Garrett Osborne. I'm a sustaining member, and I will continue to do so as long as I'm standing.
Following last week's reality check about Hawaii gas and its place in the green energy movement, we heard from Johnny on Maui. He writes, I'm really concerned with the idea that gas is trying to compete with solar for power generation. It's backwards to choose an off-island resource in order to supply power. The simple facts for those of us with solar water heating is that gas is the most cost-effective backup for heating water. Water heating uses the most power for any Hawaii resident. Let's separate these two issues. Regardless of politics, gas is more efficient for heating and for producing energy in the islands. It is a no-brainer. Solar wins every time. Another reality check that pinged your radar was Nick Ruby's coverage of the Supreme Court hearing in Washington, D.C. about the Maui case involving the Clean Water Act.
My name is Jill. I'm calling from Maui. I was just listening to your program, and it was the Civil Beat portion of the program about Maui County's lawsuit going up to the Supreme Court. And he said that Maui County wanted this. We just wanted to make sure here in Maui that it's not Maui County, it's Mayor Victorino who wanted this. So we just want to make sure that everybody knows it's not Maui County, it's just him. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Bye-bye.
And Michelle Rothstein and Kaneohe enjoyed our backyard quiz last week. She says, you guys just gave me the onos for loco moco, specifically kimchi fried rice loco moco from Big City Diner with sauteed mushrooms and onions. Hey, thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line 792-8217. Aloha as cultural exchange. That's what Kauai journalist John Lettman hoped to accomplish when he accompanied Code Pink on a recent outreach mission to Iran. The woman-led organization has been active in protesting war, militarism, and in supporting human rights since 2002. The Conversation's Harrison Patino recently spoke with Lettman about what he learned from the outreach mission and how he jumped at the chance to bring a little bit of aloha to a land far away.
Code Pink is a women-led grassroots organization. They're working to end U.S. wars and oppose militarism, and they support peace and human rights initiatives with the goal of redirecting taxpayer money to help fund health care, education, green jobs, and other programs. My role, I'm not a member of Code Pink, but I did join this delegation to Iran, and so I went with some of the Code Pink members.
So obviously there are a lot of tensions between the United States and Iran. What was it like to be there in light of this recent tension?
Well, despite all the doom and gloom that you see in the news, and I'm not denying that there are not major problems, there certainly are, but despite the image that I think most people have, when we arrived in Iran, I mean, things are calm, things are normal, things are ordinary, people are busy, they're going about their days. Iran is a very highly developed, very sophisticated nation, and it feels in many ways kind of similar to what you'd expect in the U.S. or Europe. And so it didn't feel, there's not a feeling of tension.
So it might be, due to small part of the media that we're led to believe that a sort of overlying tension between these two countries is a daily occurrence there. But did you go in there with any of those sort of misconceptions?
Well, no. I mean, I'd read quite a bit about Iran, and I've talked to a lot of people who spend time there or who live there. And so I had a pretty good sense of what to expect, and it was fairly similar to what I imagined. But, there's a lot of pressure on the people of Iran right now coming from the U.S. economic sanctions. And that's pressure which, even if we didn't see in our short stay, we were there for 1 week. So it's hard to really get the full nuance of the struggles of people's everyday lives. But we heard it from people again and again that they're under constant pressure. And people were very open and vocal in their criticism of their own government and of the government of the United States. And an important point of distinction is that the people in Iran that I met, anyway, universally made a very clear distinction between U.S. government policies and the American people. The American people generally are very, very well received there, and people were really warm and welcoming.
So what would you say the overall goal of this trip was, and what did you walk away from it learning?
The goal of the trip was pretty straightforward. It was to kind of spread a message of peace and help build some people-to-people relations between Americans and Iranians. It was a rare chance, because not many Americans are going there these days. It was a chance for a few Americans, a dozen of us anyway, to explore a little bit of Iran and to learn more about the impact of our own government's policies, the sanctions, the ongoing threat of war, and how that affects the everyday lives of ordinary Iranian people.
Now, I understand that besides your standard cultural exchange, there was a bit of aloha exchange as well. Isn't that right?
That's right. We were advised to bring some gifts just to share with people because it's such a gift-sharing culture. And so I picked up, there's a shop here on Kauai called Aloha Exchange. I picked up some stickers that say, Aloha brings change, which I thought was a nice message. Aloha brings change, because if anything, the relationship between Iran and the U.S. needs change, and it needs aloha. So I thought that was a great gift. So I picked up a bunch of those from the local store here on Kauai, and I brought them, and I gave them to people. And a lot of people speak English there really well. And so when I was giving them to people, I'd explain what Hawaii was, where it was, and I explained what aloha was, and I said, well, this is kind of like, it means like love and respect. And so people really liked that message, and I gave them the sticker as just a little gift from Hawaii, and hopefully it'll help bring us closer together.
Now, I don't know if you had a full debrief for them after you gave them these gifts, but the idea that aloha brings change, how do you think that resonated with the people that you met?
Oh, I think they liked it, and I think that's something that they'll probably think more about, and hopefully it'll stay with them for a long time, and they probably never heard the word aloha before, but they certainly have now.
Do you think that idea that sharing aloha is one of the ways to share cultural exchange?
Sure, definitely. It was a good way to step into Iranian culture, to bring a bit of Hawaii to Iran.
Well, that's wonderful. John Lettman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That was the conversation's Harrison Patino talking to Kauai journalist John Lettman about his involvement in a recent Code Pink outreach mission to Iran. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Can galaxies burp? Well, we now check in with HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer. He talks about a mysterious gas with University of Hawaii astronomer Christopher Phillips.
Stargazer time, our weekly voyage into the massive universe surrounding our tiny planet and also things we can try and look for in our dark skies. As usual, we are grateful to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips at our disposal, and we welcome him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do we have this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. So this week's stargazers, the bright planets of Jupiter and Saturn could be found in the south after sunset. The planet Venus can also be seen low in the west just after the sun sets. The moon is passing through its full phase this week, and so stargazing for those faint objects in the heavens is going to be a bit tricky due to the brightness of the moon.
Now, I understand there's a very exciting development about a mysterious galaxy and its belching gas of some kind.
Indeed. A team using the Hubble Space Telescope and the Atacama Millimeter Array in Chile have discovered a distant galaxy that appears to be blowing out huge clouds of gas into the space between galaxies. The team believes that the outbursts are the result of powerful stellar winds, earning this galaxy the nickname Makani, which is the Hawaiian word for wind.
And these winds come from newborn stars. There must be a lot of them to trigger this kind of thing.
That's the theory, but some of these powerful winds may also be coming from dying stars that explode as supernovae. A supernova is incredibly powerful and can send bursts of radiation and fast-moving matter out into space. The mystery is how this all began in the first place.
Well, one thing could be merging galaxies, right? That could trigger something like this.
Absolutely. What we could be looking at here is the aftermath of a galaxy merger. It's possible that merging galaxies can trigger rapid starbursts, and it's entirely possible that this huge outflow of gas could be driven by such an intense period of stellar birth and even death.
Sounds like we just discovered it. You think we can get a big prize or something for this?
Oh, if only.
It's Christopher Phillips and another fun Stargazer report. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Information Technology and Communication Primary Facility at McMurdo Station, Antarctica. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, FerraroChoi.com.
In this morning's Veterans Day quiz, we focused on the history of the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, what we know as Punch Bowl Cemetery. As far back as the 1890s, officials in Hawaii contemplated using a site atop Punch Bowl as a cemetery. But it wasn't until the 1940s that construction plans were actually formulated. The first major push came from a $50,000 congressional appropriation that requested the construction of a national cemetery in Honolulu. While in the planning phase, it became apparent that the appropriation would be too small to cover all the costs, so the plans were ultimately scrapped. But by 1947, however, Congress and veterans organizations requested that a permanent burial site be constructed for thousands of World War II servicemen who had not yet been interred. After the Army revamped the previous plans to construct a Punch Bowl Cemetery, Congress approved the necessary funding, and construction finally began. The cemetery opened to the public July 19, 1949, but that was several months after the first servicemen were laid to rest there. For today's backyard quiz, we were wondering if you could tell us when the first servicemen were interred at Punch Bowl, and the answer was January 4th, 1949. Congratulations to our winner, Laura Fink of Honolulu got it right. She actually was up there this morning. She's a tour guide, and she says that cemetery, that spot is significant to her also because her grandfather is buried there. If you have an idea for a quiz, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the real estate agents and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HPR's commitment to sharing local stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
Schedules are there for a reason, but sometimes you may find a need to throw that schedule out the window. That's kind of what happened on Maui. David Ward, the dance director for Seabury Hall, shared with us why he is staging Catch Me If You Can. You may know it as a film starring Leonardo DiCaprio, but it's also a play that needs a lot of male actors.
I loved your pitch. I can just see these young boys saying, "Please, Mr. Ward, I want to sing and dance."
Can you believe it? I know.
So how could you say no?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, we only do a musical every other year at Seabury because we're a small school. And, you know, it takes a lot on both the students and the staff when we're putting together one of these big musicals. And last year we did Anything Goes. And really, for the very first time, I had 15 boys audition last year. And, I mean, that is like so unheard of. I'm lucky to get 6 or 8 and, you know, to come out for a musical. And it was awesome. It was a big success. The kids were incredible. So then after the show, they were so inspired, they just started coming up to me really individually around campus. Oh, come on, please, let's do one next year, you know. So, and because half of them are seniors this year, I just thought, there is no way I can pass up this opportunity, right? So me and my vocal director, Molly Shad, started searching for kind of the perfect vehicle, you know, that would be male-centric and really for the first time promote the men, the young boys in musicals rather than focusing on, you know, women, strong women's roles, because of course that's what we usually have. So it's been really fun to find this show, to decide on Catch Me If You Can, which is a great story with phenomenal music. We are both just so in love with the musical score to this show. It's so much fun.
Well, I'm not familiar with the music, but I know about the film.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's also, that's the other thing. It's a, you know, everyone knows saw the movie, or many people. So it's a true story. You know, I love the period, of course, the 1960s, the costumes and so on. But the music, the team was Mark Scheinman and Scott Whitman, and they were the same team who wrote Hairspray. And their lyrics and their music are just so smart and really clever.
So for folks who aren't familiar with the film or the musical, the story in a nutshell is what?
Well, it's about this young boy, Frank Jr. Abagnale, who he ran away from home when he was like 16, 17 years old, and he went to New York because there was family difficulty going on at home. And he just became one of the most recognized con men ever, right? So he ended up figuring out a way to live and survive by cashing fraudulent checks. I think he ended up cashing a total of over $2 million worth of fraudulent checks. But more importantly, he ended up changing his identity, and he became an airline pilot, he became a doctor, he became a lawyer, all just by having people believe, you know, the way he convinced people that that's who he was without any experience. I mean, he spent a year traveling around as a co-pilot for Pan Am Airlines. I mean, this is kind of an unbelievable story.
So I imagine it's a hit with the kids.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, just the boys, there's FBI agents.
Men in
you know,
black.
There's all these airline pilots. You know, it really is. The boys love the characters in this show.
So, I mean, I recall a time when, you know, everybody on the stage was all male, right? You had males playing women's parts way back when.
Oh, well, yeah. Oh, sure. When you go back to Shakespeare and all of that sort of stuff. But even honestly, you know, I've been doing musical theater for 35 years. And when I'm trying to find a show to do, I struggle because most shows, most musicals are still male dominant, right? There may be 2 female roles and 7 male roles or, you know, something like that, like 4 male roles to 2. So to find shows that are, you know, that have a lot of women's parts in it is not easy necessarily. And, but I, you know, you manage, you do MAME, you do Hello Dolly, you know, there's a lot of them that are out there that do have strong female characters. And so it was really fun to kind of finally go to a place where I could focus on a strong male cast.
So I imagine, though, it's pretty neat because, as you mentioned, these young boys are seniors now. They'll be graduating. This is kind of one nice little memory for their senior year they can tuck away.
Yeah, and you know what? I got to say, one of the things that I think is going to happen from this show that I'm just sensing right now, I mean, half the cast are seniors, and of course I've got some freshman, sophomore, junior boys as well. I have 13 boys in the cast. But because there's been 2 years in a row with this much enthusiasm, and we have such, I can just feel the buzz from the student body who are going to come and see this show. I really believe it's just going to, you know, just convince other young men that it's okay to sing and dance and act and get out there and do musical comedy. So, I mean, these guys are doing such a service. Not only are they having a great life experience, but they're really opening the door for other boys. And I just would like to just kind of segue into something that I think is really important that these boys are learning in this show. You know, we're doing this 1960s show, not unlike a show on television like Mad Men or something, where women are often portrayed, you know, on the sexist side, right? They're often the secretaries, the stewardesses, the nurses in the show, which in this particular show. And so it's really brought up some fantastic conversations. So although we're looking at this as a period of time in the 1960s, the conversations the cast are having about how young women are treated and where what they're, you know, how they were portrayed back then, it's just really been great. I feel like there's been so much growth, and the boys have really heard and listened to these young women speak about, you know, how things are progressing and how they want to be empowered. And so we're trying to keep it as a historic time thing, but also look at how can we change? How can we do this better as we move forward?
The mark of a wonderful educator, a teaching moment. You seize them where
exactly.
You see them.
I hope so.
And so as far as what goes forward, I mean, it's like, oh, gulp, like, what did we do 2 years in a row? Yeah, you have your Wheaties?
Yeah,
are you going to be able to do this next year?
I'm sorry, say that again?
So are you going to be able to do this next year?
No. I am clearly going to take a break next year because I also try and do every other year, I try and do this a community dance festival where we invite different groups from all over the island to perform. And so I have to kind of pick and choose. I can only do so many productions a year and still, you know, I have a family, I have a job, I have a life. But no, I am so passionate about musical theater. This summer, the school gave me some professional development money. I was able to spend a month in New York studying. I did some Broadway theater workshops. I saw 12 Broadway shows. You know, I came back. I'm so inspired. I could really actually do this again next year. I love working with these kids. I love seeing them step outside their comfort zone. And, you know, Seabury Hall has been so supportive of our program here. So, yeah, I mean, although I'm tired and I say I don't want to do it again next year, honestly, you ask me, you know, 3 weeks after the show and I could. I would.
Well, it sounds like you're having a terrific time, and I'm sure the boys are just grateful that they'll be able to sing and dance, Mr. Ward.
Well, yes, and thank you so much, really, for taking the time to talk to me about this and your support of arts education in Hawaii and local theater. I'm really grateful.
All right. Well, it's our pleasure. And we wish you luck. Break a leg.
Thank you.
We were talking to David Ward, the dance director of Maui's Seabury Hall. The upcoming production of Catch Me If You Can opens on Friday, November 15th at the school's campus in Makawao. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org for more information about the show.
The genre has been described as having a high, lonesome sound, but when the Saloon Pilots do bluegrass, it's much more than that. Join us in HPR's Atherton Studio Saturday, November 23rd for a return performance by one of Hawaii's popular bluegrass and Americana groups. They bring intricate vocal and instrumental renditions for a high-energy concert experience. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
That wraps it up for this hour. Up tomorrow, we talk to a local artist whose homemade film is currently playing in film festivals in Europe. We would like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. Call 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, go to The Conversation page on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.